Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call to order the Health and Human Services Finance Division. We do have several things on the agenda today, and we have testifiers here. So as we wait for members to get into the room, we unfortunately don't have a quorum yet, but we expect to have one shortly. But anyway, we're going to start by hearing House File 230. Representative Joaquim, if you would want to come up to the table. And let's see here. 230. We have the bill. Oh, there it is. Okay. And so since Representative Joaquim is not on the committee, the chair will move House File 230 that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with recommendation that it go to the Capital Investment Committee. So, members, this is essentially a capital investment bill that we are hearing in this committee because it relates to health and human services, but its ultimate destination is capital investment. And I know that the advocates for the bill and Representative Joaquim are very much hoping that it will be part of a capital investment bill. So with that, we're going to just hear a little bit about what the program is that the bill would be supporting, and then we hopefully will send the bill on its way. So Representative Joaquim, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Liebling and committee members. I think this is my first stop ever. Well, no, I might have done one other bill in HHS, but I want to thank you so much for the opportunity to explain to you about a program that's near and dear to my heart, Perspectives, Inc. While it's based in St. Louis Park, it provides regional services to homeless women and their children. It's been providing those services for 40 years and has an absolutely wonderful track record you'll hear a little bit about today. They provide supportive housing and clinical service treatment programs for mothers, as well as both academic nutrition enrichment programs for children. And over the course of the years, they've outgrown their building in both space and services that they need to provide to both mothers and their children. The total cost for Perspectives expansion project is $12 to $13 million, and the bill before you requests $4.5 million in bonds. In 2017, the project received a $600,000 pre-design grant from the state legislature, and they have put it to good use. The planning money has been spent, and the required plans, designs, and specifications are now complete. The project is shovel-ready to begin construction in 2020 if the legislature so chooses to approve the GO bonding request in the bill this year. I would especially like to thank Representative Tony Albright for carrying this bill the last 2 years and helping usher across the finish line the planning money. And I'd also like to thank bipartisan support the bill has had in the past from Representative Keel, Kreisha, and Uglum, as well as many other of our colleagues, a lot of them who have already moved on to bigger and brighter things. Currently, Senator Senjum is carrying the bill in the other body, and I know you have a full agenda today, so I am going to actually turn this over to the rest of the presentation to Jeannie Seeley-Smith, the President and CEO of Perspectives, Inc., who will quickly explain their program and what the project would mean to them. But first, we're going to hear from Karen Barton, the Community Development Director for the City of St. Louis Park, and she'll discuss the city's role in the bill.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Joaquim. And actually, I got a little bit ahead of myself before because you can't move a bill before you have a quorum. So, and we still do not have a quorum. So when we get a quorum, we will officially move the bill.
Sounds
good. It's not really a problem. But in the meantime, Ms. Barton, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Karen Barton. I'm the Community Development Director for the City of St. Louis Park. And on behalf of the City of St. Louis Park, I just want to express our strong support for this bonding request. The City has an exceptional relationship with Perspectives and has for many, many years, and we wholeheartedly support and embrace the work that they do in our community. We are really proud to have them as a part of our community and appreciate their services. The services they provide are very critical to so many people and are desperately needed in the metro area and across the region. The expansion that they're proposing with this bonding will not only allow them to enhance those critical services, but it also aids the city in the revitalization of our historic Walker Lake area, which is where they are located, and furthers our city goals and strategic priorities. We are very pleased to be the municipal sponsors of this bonding request to aid in their expansion and are very committed to helping them reach their goals. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And we have one other testifier. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Jeannie Seeley-Smith, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of Perspectives. As the president and CEO of more than 36 years and the founder of our existing programs, I had numerous occasions over these years to present to elective officials. However, each time, and today without exception, is that I'm always humbled and a bit moved. As a political science major, I am inspired by this process and so admire each one of you for your dedication and hard work and safeguarding the and enhancing the citizens of Minnesota. So thank you. And thank you in advance for what you accomplished this session, and congratulations to all of you who are entering your first year of service. Perspectives is especially grateful to Representative Yuka Kim, who has been consistent and a passionate voice for not only Perspectives, but for her constituents that live in District 43B. To have a representative who's held in such high regard and enjoys such a stellar reputation and well-deserved makes us even prouder to have your name as our chief author.
Thank you. We like her, too.
Thank you. And also we wish to thank the great city of St. Louis Park, who is supporting this bill as our municipal sponsor, and grateful to have Karen here today with us. I'm known for saying when I speak on homelessness that it takes more than a house to end homelessness. It's not about just about getting families off the street. It's about getting them on their feet. In fact, Perspectives' expertise is not in homelessness. Our expertise is in recovery. Yet we address the core issues that address homelessness: poverty, lack of access, racial disparity, untreated trauma, mental illness, and addiction. If you turn to page 5 on your brochure, you'll see a picture of Perspectives Housing Campus. This is the brochure that you have, hopefully you all have in your packet, this one. So we are the largest therapeutic housing program in the state, perhaps the Midwest. At any given time, we are housing 53 women and over 100 children when they arrive. It's not an exaggeration to say that they are arriving from the streets of hell. They have been bounced around in emergency housing shelters, their drug houses, jails, tents, institutions, and even cars. They arrive broken and traumatized, desperate. Their children are frightened and emotionally damaged.
And tragically, if I could just pause for one second. Yeah. And members, I just want to point out that she's referring to this brochure. It is in your packets. It got put in with the other bill. So you can find it if you look in the other folder.
And you will see our housing campus.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tragically, the children who come to us have lacked most of the basic resources that most children have had at their age. They lack nurturing homes, healthy food, art, literature, music. They're raised in poverty and abuse. And if they arrive and they are school age, most generally they are 2 years behind in school, socially inept, and emotionally damaged. Most have open child protection cases. Yet although the families enter our program with horrific histories, they still arrive holding on to their quest for sobriety. And still those haunted memories they still have of their lost hopes and dreams. We can see that in their eyes they are hoping beyond hope for a sense of purpose, restoration, dignity, and a solid pathway to rebuild their lives. And even more critically, they come in hopes to break that cycle of despair for their children. Now, the Perspectives does not believe it is incumbent on us to save them, because we alone cannot. But we do believe it is incumbent on our community to provide them with the opportunity to save themselves and to remove those barriers that block their opportunity to do so. Because the program was developed to provide women with an environment of healing, when a woman and a child arrive, they move into their completely furnished apartment. We know by their reaction over our decades that a completely furnished apartment sends a very strong message that we believe in you. And the community who has donated much of the furnishings sends the sound message as well. We believe in you. It is a powerful message. For so many, it is the first time that anyone has believed in them. Yet we know to be successful, they will eventually have to believe in themselves. Their awakening, if it does occur, and it does for probably over 85%, comes through the hard work from our multidisciplinary team of therapists, case managers, teachers, addiction counselors, recovery coaches, nutritionists, teachers, volunteers. This circle of support was meticulously designed and built over these past decades to stabilize the family with an integrated system of care representing a best practice called a trauma-informed environment. That best practice is now becoming widely known, but Perspectives takes credit in implementing it years ago. Our motto is in, up, and out compared to in, up, and back. And the majority of that up and out is done in the family center. It is there where our life-changing programs occurs, and that without these services, we know that we cannot move the women forward, that they will be stuck in the cycle of dysfunction and despair. Yes, they have an apartment with four walls around them, but without intervention, nothing will change. And they will recycle back into homelessness. And their children will have no opportunity to break the cycle. And that is why we are here today. Our 60-year-old family center, which we renovated and bought 25 years ago, at the time a broken-down office building that took us several thousand dollars just to bring it up to an occupancy permit, is falling apart. It no longer is able to sustain our services, nor can we see how we can be effective with the challenges that we have with today's population. Please know that Perspectives is extremely grateful to you that in 2017 you provided us with a $600,000 pre-design grant that provided us with the dollars to design the building that you see laid out on page 12 and 13, if you turn to page 12 and 13 in your brochure. These critical dollars have allowed us to dream big. 16,000 additional square feet will be added to the center, of which 4,000 will be allocated to a very critically needed early childhood development program. It is in the rebuilding and the expansion of our family center that we will not only sustain our future, but will also provide the environment where the miracles of recovery will continue to be born, and not only born, but forged by the support of a vibrant community who will gather around as cheerleaders, perhaps with pom-poms. Who doesn't need that? The new family center is where children will have success and access to academic and social enrichment programs. And our Kids Cafe, now just announced on Friday, the Cargill Kids Cafe, with a $500,000 naming grant that we just were notified of, will eat healthy foods. And they will also learn to trust adults again, which is difficult for them. It is the adults, most likely their parents, who have victimized them. But in this new and exciting healing environment, opportunity will be provided that can unlock their endless potential. So in closing, with your help, together we will build a place of dignity and safety, a culturally sensitive environment that sends the message from our state capital to our families that you, too, believe in them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Joaquin.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to add a few more things. Ms. Healy Smith is very, very modest, and she wouldn't tell you that in 40 years they have an 85% success rate of women breaking cycles and building hope and coming out of homelessness and poverty and being contributing members to society. And the reason why this family center is so desperately needed is that they're seeing this trend, a very sad trend, a lot of us have learned about in HHS policy and education, of the trauma that the kids are starting to come with their mothers, and that the kids need just as much support services nowadays than their mothers to get past those barriers that they have to be successful. So that is kind of one of the undercurrents that we have right now is not just to provide the expansion to make sure the mothers are getting the job training, the addiction counseling, and all that they need to be successful, but that the kids are getting the support. They have certified teachers that come and get them caught up to school. They feed them at night. If you ever want to come with me to do their kids cook program, you can come and volunteer in the kitchen where 10 kids take the lead and help you prepare a meal for the rest of the children. And just these kiddos coming in just need much more support than what the space is allowed to give them to with an early childhood center as well. So thank you. I stand for questions.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Joaquim and testifiers. So we do have quorum. So I'm going to officially move House File 230 that it be recommended to that it be re-referred to Ways and Means and recommended to be then re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee. And I also would like to entertain a motion to approve the minutes of the February 12th meeting. So we have Representative Cantrell moves the minutes of the February 12th meeting of this committee. Is there any discussion to the minutes? I know, don't everybody fight over the minutes. Is there any discussion?
We haven't had a lot of fights.
Seeing none, all right, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Thank you very much, members. So Representative Acom has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Joaquim and Ms. Seeley-Smith. Is that right?
Yes.
I just wanted to ask you a little bit more. You talk about the family center and a lot of focus on young people, and you're also Representative Joaquim told us a little bit about the success you have in the moms and in the success that they've had. So can you tell us a little bit about the kids and how they come in, how they're dealt with, and maybe how better they are to go forward?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, the children, of course, are at the heart of Perspectives, and it was the reason for our first initiative of purchasing the family center that we have now. When we first started working with the moms, we were thinking that we would probably have Little House on the Prairie. The moms would come and the kids would come and everybody would be happy. But what happened is that the kids were terribly damaged. And we saw where they would be acting out. At age 12, they were stealing cars and they were truant from school and smoking pot. And the young children that we had at our family center would be throwing chairs and having meltdowns. And there's such little intervention available for us when a child is in such crisis. There just are not the resources for us to be able to reach out quickly. So that was one of the reasons why we wanted to build even a better center to enlarge our Kids Cafe and our Kids Connection program. The kids are from age infants. Mothers arrive, some are pregnant. And then we have a child that could be with us from infants right through sixth grade. They don't live in our program that long, but a lot of them will relocate and the children will stay with us, which is to us, you know, that is a great success for them to stay. They come and as I mentioned, they don't trust adults. It takes a long time for that safety to happen, for them to be able to reach out and have a smile again. But they do, and they do heal. And we are, I think our Kids Cafe and our Kids Connection program, sometimes we say this is a place they come where everyone knows their name, because we don't just know that child. But the school is very excited to work with us, a very strong partner, because we not only know the child, but we know that parent, and we know the grandparent, and we know what's happening in that home. You know, we know if there is a crisis or if a mother has relapsed. So the children are damaged. Every single one of them come to us have PTSD. They lived in shelters. They have heard nothing but addiction and violence around them from the time that they were young. So between the ages, while we have them, so much can be done. I mean, the research is just huge on what you can do to intervene with a child from the time they are 1 to 3 to be able to overcome that toxic stress that they have experienced. So it's, I hope that answers your question.
It does, thank you.
A little bit more than you probably asked. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, too, wanted to ask about the children, because in your new expansion, you're going to have an early childhood development center, and yet it says on page 11 that this is for children aged 16 months through preschool. And we've heard reports about how the most difficult and most important brain development time is actually before that. I've read studies that say homeless kids under the age of two actually suffer more trauma than the older kids because they can't put it in perspective. They can't understand when mom says this is temporary or whatever. And so tell us again, how are you going to serve those under 16 months since they're not targeted for your new expansion?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. Just a case in point that I usually don't always see residents that move in. Last week, a woman came from shelter, and her newborn was 3 months. And she had been there. She's in child protection. They're allowing her to have the baby with her. She's very excited about having this new infant with her. And moving into a place where she will have her own, everything furnished, a crib, you know, everything for her, you know, the linens and pots and pans and everything is in our apartment buildings. But when she was in shelter, that young child, to your point, was here. She was in a room with two other women, and the women screamed at her through the night that her child was crying. So they would move her, and then it would happen again. And then they are taken from, and then every morning she has to go down someplace, you know, at the city to get a voucher on where she's going to stay again. So it's exactly right. The young children, the infants, do suffer tremendously. But I think our program will have a great deal of parenting. And we just received a $1.5 million SAMHSA grant in the fall of last year to really develop a very sophisticated and comprehensive parenting program. We would encourage that mom to bond with that child instead of bringing that child to the early childhood development program. We would work with her to have her in the parenting program and to come for playtime with that child. To have an infant program, we will have to grow into that. That's, you know, that's another, so there's two reasons. One, philosophically, we would like the mom to be with the infant, but other, that there is almost a one-to-one ratio. So we want to grow into infants and work with the mom while she's there, but while we launch this program, it's brand new. We don't see it in fully up for about 3 years when we start doing that.
Representative Loft. Well,
thank you, Madam Chair, and I would just ask that you really think hard about that, because actually, I mean, you're moving the parents through school, hopefully, if they haven't completed school, or into work, stabilizing them so they're ready to be independent in 2 years. And that means the child is going to be in child care, and the hardest to find child care is under 16 months. Mm-hmm. And the number, I'm told that more kids are kicked out of preschool than out of high school. And it's very hard to find child care facilities that will take a child who has behavior issues, particularly at that very young age where it's harder to work with them. And so I hope that you're able to accelerate your plan to work with them.
And Chair, thank you. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And I just have a brief question how the bill operates. Maybe Representative Joachim or maybe someone from the Department of Human Services. So if you notice, the bill has the bond proceeds to the Commissioner of Human Services for a grant to the City of St. Louis Park, and that's a little bit unusual. And since we are the HHS Finance Division, I thought it would be good to just understand that. Ms. Seeley-Smith, maybe you can explain that to us, or maybe if we need DHS, we could call them down. Can you answer that? Ms. Seeley-Smith?
Madam Chair, the city is our municipal sponsor, so the monies will flow through Human Services, yeah. I think, to them, or because it's probably not a grant to the city, maybe that I'm not sure about the writing of the bill, because it will be a bond.
Okay.
Our last bill was a grant for $600,000 that we did receive that as a cash grant.
Okay. Maybe Representative Joaquin can help. This is more of a technical issue, I think.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you for taking a stab at it, Representative Joaquin.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I'm going to phone a friend and have Mr. Jim Erickson come down and speak to this.
Thank you, Representative.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Jim Erickson, Madam Chair, representing.
And you'll need to pull the mic, Mr. Erickson. Thank
representing
you.
Perspectives. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question. I want to just emphasize again that this is going to the city as a GO bond. The city needs to own the facility, as those of you who have been involved in bonding before, and that's why it goes to, it has to go to one of the departments. This is standard language that is drafted. So if we're going to give money to the city, our government sponsor, it goes to a department, and then they make a grant to the city. The city then puts the money into the project. We lease it. It's owned by the city, so the state can sell general obligation bonds. So I believe, Madam Chair, this is standard procedure. It was drafted by the revisor's office pursuant to this new change. And again, I would suggest that we first got cash money 2 years ago for the $600,000. We now decided that, frankly, the $4.5 million would be difficult to get into a cash portion of a bill. So now we are going to be in the larger bonding portion of a bill, and I guess I would use the opportunity to encourage the legislature to pass a fairly large bonding bill this year, but that's an aside. But that's the answer. I think that's the technical answer, and I think we're correct, and unless somebody from DHS or revisor's office would correct me.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Erickson. I understand the part about, you know, that we don't bond directly to a nonprofit and it goes through the city, and that's all fine. I'm just, you know, curious, because we don't see this very often, that the bond funds are going to the Commissioner of Human Services to make a grant, kind of why they're inserted in the middle. And I just want to make sure, as we have this in this committee, that that's something that the department is comfortable doing. Is there somebody from DHS who can just comment on that? I just don't see it very often. Maybe we do it, and I just don't notice it. But here we have a testifier. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jennifer Sommerfeld. I'm the Legislative Director for Children and Family Services. I don't deal directly with the bonding, but this would come through partially CFS and partially through the DHS Central Office is my understanding, but this is fairly common that we get bonding funds and we grant them out to municipalities or other organizations that are intended to receive them.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. That's all. Since I haven't seen it a lot, I just want to make sure it was kind of in the ordinary course. Are there other questions from members? Representative Funish-Padin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Joachim and the testifiers. Would you just tell us a little bit about the families that stay there? I know that all these microphones are in our way. And I'm sort of curious, like, how long is the average stay? How large is the family that might be there? Are dads allowed? If there is a male partner, are they allowed to live or be on the grounds with the family? I'm just sort of curious about what that family makeup looks like.
And if you could just kind of answer briefly, because we're sort of out of time for this segment. So
I'm sorry.
That would be no problem, Representative Funish-Padin, but, you know, we just want to finish up here so we can pass your bill along.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. The families look very different. All the women who come, it's for only women. So they are single women with their children. They are homeless, and they are recovering, and they have dual diagnosis. Okay. That part, they all look alike, you know, in that sense. They all share the same type of tragedy in their life. They can come and stay within one component of our program, which is the transitional component. That's two apartment buildings. They can stay there for 2 years. They can stay if they move into permanent housing. If they come in through permanent housing, they're able to stay there longer. The families, we have seen smaller families and younger women. There were a time we had a woman maybe with six children. The average woman has probably two children, maybe 1.5 children. So and men are allowed on campus if they have had background checks and they are considered to be a healthy influence for the family.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 230 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with further recommendation that it be sent to the Capital Investment Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much for coming and presenting to us today.
Thank you so much.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
We are going to move on now to a brief overview of regarding prescription drugs from the Department of Human Services, and then we are going to hear Representative Lippert's bill on the prescription drug repository program. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Chad Hope. I'm the Deputy Director for the Division of Purchasing and Service Delivery at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I also oversee the pharmacy program for the department. Today I'm going to do a brief presentation that talks about some general high-level overview information about the pharmacy benefit. Excuse me. And the second part, talk about some issues we've been having with federal compliance related to the covered outpatient drug rule, as well as some work we've been doing with stakeholders to craft a framework to be compliant with the rule in a way where there can be consensus within the community. Pharmacy services within the Medicaid program are surprisingly an optional benefit. Every state Medicaid program in the country offers pharmacy services. However, it's not a benefit that has to be offered as part of the Medicaid program. Even though it's an optional benefit, it's important to highlight that that doesn't necessarily mean that the state could choose to not offer pharmacy services across the board. There are federal requirements for children under the age of 21 under the early periodic screening, diagnostic, and treatment component of the Medicaid program that require a state Medicaid program to provide all medically necessary state plan services, even optional services, regardless of whether or not the state offers them to the Medicaid population as a whole. So what that really means is a state could elect to eliminate the pharmacy benefit for adults. However, they really cannot elect to eliminate it for children. The EPSDT requirement, one thing to note, does not require the coverage of experimental drugs, so they actually have to be FDA-approved medications. State Medicaid programs, including Minnesota, we have limited ability to manage what is on our formulary, and in actuality, we're not really able to have a formulary. If a manufacturer participates in the federal Medicaid drug rebate program, we have to cover their drug in some form or fashion. We can apply various edits to them, and I'll briefly touch on those in a moment. But what's important is if the manufacturer participates, we have to cover the drug. The limited exceptions that exist are pretty narrow, and they include drugs that are used for cosmetic purposes, for hair growth or removal, and there's a few other exceptions in the federal law. There are two primary ways that DHS pays for prescription drugs. The first is through the fee-for-service program, where DHS processes the claim and directly pays providers for prescription drugs for our members. The second is we contract with managed care organizations who provide the pharmacy benefit on behalf of the state. So they are directly processing the claims and issuing the payments. There are also primarily two ways that members access prescription drugs. The first way on the left there is outpatient pharmacy. These are prescription drugs that you would go to a pharmacy in the community and they dispense them to you for self-administration at the home. So those are billed by a pharmacy as a pharmacy claim. The second way is when you're either in a facility, a clinic, some sort of medical setting, and the medication is administered to a member. Those are billed as part of the medical claim, and it's part of the medical benefit. So even though they're prescription drugs and they're governed by the same federal requirements, they're billed in two very different ways. Pharmacy reimbursement, as we've all heard, is extremely complicated, yet at the same time, it's really pretty simple. You have to pay for the parts, and you have to pay for the labor. The parts are the drug. So we pay for the drug, and we'll talk about issues we're having with that on with federal compliance. And then we also have to pay the pharmacy for the service of dispensing the medication. So that would be the labor. There are certainly exceptions to that, but the vast majority of pharmacy claims compose of just reimbursement for the drug and then the professional services for dispensing. The pharmacy benefit can be managed in a couple different ways, though within a Medicaid program we're a little limited. We can apply prior authorization to a drug to ensure that it's safe and effective. And when appropriate, we can apply a cost principle so that we're covering a lower cost alternative. However, it's worth noting that that option really doesn't exist for a lot of the high cost specialty drug classes where there isn't competition. We can also apply a preferred drug list, and that is when we do have competition within a drug class, say for instance, blood pressure medications, we can leverage the cost savings because these medications have relatively equally efficacious and safety profiles so that we can steer utilization to the lowest cost option while providing a medically necessary service for our members. But again, the Medicaid program is a little limited in that we can't simply exclude a drug from our benefit if the manufacturer participates in the federal rebate program. So what is this federal Medicaid rebate program I keep talking about? It's fairly complicated. Rebates are given to the state and then shared with the federal government. The drug rebates are spelled out in federal law, and there are a number of complicating factors. The base rebate calculation for a brand name drug is usually 23.1% of the average manufacturing price. There are exceptions to the percentage, and the average manufacturing price, as it's defined in federal law, isn't actually the price that it costs the manufacturer to manufacture the drug. So there's a lot of complicating factors there. CMS actually, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services actually calculates the rebate amounts and then distributes those to the states to do the invoicing. Generic drugs, the rebate percentage is lower than brand name drugs, and that goes along with the generic drugs having a lower cost. An interesting piece of the federal Medicaid rebate program is that states are essentially barred from sharing information on not only drug prices, but the rebates with anyone outside of the agency. So we can talk about how much we've paid for prescription drugs in the aggregate. We can talk about how much we've collected in rebates in the aggregate, but federal law will not allow me to say drug X costs us this amount and the rebate is this.
Representative Hamilton, did you have a question?
I have a lot of questions, Madam Chair. I'll save one just right now. Why is that? Why won't the federal government allow us?
Yeah, Mr. Hope.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have the answer to why. I certainly like to distribute this information as widely as possible so that folks know that that prohibition does exist in federal law.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Hamilton.
If you could, at a later date, with your best attempt, try to tell us why and what we can do about it as at a state level, if we need to put pressure on the feds or what. I am trying to keep my blood pressure down when I'm listening to this testimony, Madam Chair, and I'll try to be respectful, but I do have a few questions at the end of this.
Right, and Representative Hamilton, every piece that we learn more about how this crazy system works, it has that effect on me as well. I just would caution us, Mr. Hope is just the messenger.
I know.
He didn't create it. He's not defending it. He's just reporting to us how this is. So let's let him get through the rest of his presentation. We really didn't allocate a lot of time for this because we have a bill that we need to hear. But I do want to at least have a bit of a discussion. And so we'll let him get through the presentation, and then we'll put you on the list.
All right. Thank
okay.
you,
Mr. Hope, please continue.
Thank you. The next slide is just some general statistics about the pharmacy benefit for state fiscal year 2018. The short version is we spent a lot on prescription drugs, $1.1 billion, but we also get a lot back in the federal Medicaid drug rebate, $600 million. Moving on to the covered outpatient drug rule and the issues that we're having with the federal compliance with our reimbursement rate. There's a brief timeline on slide 12 that talks about the history of the covered outpatient drug rule and how we've gotten to where we're at. I won't spend a lot of time on this, but the short version is this rule came about over the course of about 5 years from 2012 to 2017. There were a number of changes to the way that state Medicaid programs were required to pay for prescription drugs, and we have attempted to make these changes in both the 2017 and 2018 legislative session. We need changes to state law in order to comply with the outpatient drug rule, and unfortunately we were unsuccessful in having those changes adopted into law. One of the changes was related to the drug reimbursement, or the parts part of the equation. Previously, the federal requirement was that the state Medicaid agency needed to use an estimated acquisition cost for the drug, or essentially what we thought the best reflection of what the cost was. The new requirement is that we have to use an actual acquisition cost, so something actually reflecting what pharmacies are purchasing the drug for. CMS publishes a benchmark called the National Average Drug Acquisition Cost, and the framework that we've been working on with the stakeholders would propose to use the National Average Drug Acquisition Cost as our basis for reimbursement, has wide support, and it is also accepted by CMS as being a compliant pricing mechanism. The second part of the outpatient drug rule that impacts the reimbursement is related to the dispensing fee. This is on the labor side of the equation. Historically, states, by paying for an estimated acquisition cost on the drug, have somewhat overpaid on the part side, but we've also been underpaying on the labor side. So when we correct the reimbursement on the parts for the drug, we also need to make sure that we're accurately reimbursing the pharmacies for their labor. So CMS requires that the state either do a dispensing fee survey or have some sort of basis for the revision to a dispensing fee. We've been working with stakeholders, and what we found as the best surrogate is the state of Indiana did a dispensing fee survey in 2017 that showed that the average cost for dispensing a prescription was $10.48. While that is significantly higher than the $3.65 we're currently paying, it's important to keep in mind that's just one side of the equation. We're also going to be lowering the reimbursement on the part side. The framework that we've been discussing also would establish ongoing cost of dispensing surveys to measure what the costs are in Minnesota so that we have a good idea of how this number equates to the cost here. During the stakeholder engagement, we've also heard from the pharmacies that the 2% Minnesota care tax, which is not currently applied to pharmacies but is applied to drug wholesalers, is a big concern for them. The framework that we have worked on would include the 2% provider tax being included on the drug side of the reimbursement if we receive federal approval for that. The second component is the hospitals that participate in the 340B program, which is a discount drug purchasing program. CMS requires that we move to an actual acquisition cost reimbursement for those pharmacies as well. So there is a additional disproportionate share hospital payment that would offset the losses through the 340B reimbursement to comply with the federal rule. And then lastly, we've really been looking for ways to make this the most cost-effective proposal when there are appropriate offsetting management strategies. We're currently prohibited in state law from managing hemophilia clotting factor on our preferred drug list. The framework that we have discussed would eliminate that prohibition so that we could engage the manufacturers and attempt to leverage a supplemental drug rebate or some sort of discount through the negotiation process. And that is the end of the presentation.
All right. Well, thank you very much. So I think we could spend a few minutes with questions. I know members probably do have a lot of them. Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Holt, my frustrations aren't with you, okay? I just want to make that very clear. And Madam Chair, if we have the opportunity to address this at another time, I'm more than happy to bring most of my questions and concerns up at that time, because I know we have a busy day. I would like to share just one story, if I could. Back in October, I went in for my monthly treatment of Tysabri. I go in once a month, and get infusion therapy, if you will, from IMS. And it is prior authorized, pre-approved. I go in, standard procedure. I've been doing it for almost 7 years. After the procedure was done in October, Lene comes home, my wife comes home, and I'm sitting at the kitchen island, and she does like she normally does, puts mail down. She opens up a letter, and she just starts crying. I said, "What's the problem?" She throws the letter down in front of me. I read it, and once again, it says denied. Not only did they deny the treatments going forward, but they are denying the one that I already received. I turned to my wife and I said, "I'll take care of it." She goes, "I know you will, but why does it have to be so difficult?" So then I started making phone calls, and I called the number that they put on the bottom of the denial. I left a message, and today they still have not returned that call, the people that are supposed to call. I started calling the contacts that I have, the chairs of HHS back in October. I started calling the lobbyists and others. I called my physician that happens to be at the Mayo Clinic and the nurse that's assigned to it. And when I shared with them what my concern was, my nurse's response was, "Oh, yeah." And I said, "Wait a minute, that's your response?" And she said, "Mr. Hamilton, this happens all the time." I said, "I have a question. How much does my infusion cost?" She said, $7,500. "I don't know about all of you, but I cannot afford $7,500 a month." And she goes, "Well, I can put you in contact with the drug company and they can set you up on a payment plan." I said, "I'm not going to do that." And I said, "What I'm going to do is I'm going to go to the press." I called the lobbyist, who I'm going to say is a very good person, and I don't want to throw them under the bus either. That's not my point. I shared with them what my concern was, and I said, "I'm going to the press." And they said, "That's a little premature." And they said, "Please just give us a few days in order for us to take care of this." Now, here's the most disgusting thing about this story. Within 5 business days, it was all taken care of. Not only did they say, "We're going to pay for the one that you already got, that you're approved, and they're going to pay for the rest going forward." If I was not a state legislator, that never would have happened. This happens all the time. We have got to fix this. On your presentation here, you talk about the average manufacturer price, the brand name drugs, and generic drugs. What has also taken place, and I don't know if legislators realize this, I think more and more of us are becoming aware. And I was talking to a legislator. They're not here, and so they will remain nameless. But they were sharing with me how they were on a generic drug, and it was working just fine. All of a sudden, they went in, and they were given a brand-name drug. And they asked, "Why is that?" And they, the best of their knowledge, and I said, "I know why that is. It is because the pharmacy benefits managers are receiving a bigger rebate back on that one. Even though it is costing the entire system more money, the pharmacy benefits managers can bank a bigger savings to make it look like it's saving more money, but it is costing the state more money than keeping that individual on the generic drug. This is so disgusting, and the system is broken so bad as it pertains to this, Madam Chair. Thank you for allowing me some time. I have more stories and more frustrations that I'm going to vent throughout this legislative session. So, again, thank you. And, Mr. Hope, thank you for your work. And none of this anger is directed towards you. But we must change this system.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. And we appreciate that. And we have always appreciated your passion around this issue. Hopefully we'll not just tell stories but move some bills.
Correct.
So that's how we really get talking around here, right? But I just want to point out that Mr. Hope is just talking about the Medicaid program, medical assistance, as we call here, and just explaining how this all works within that. But obviously the craziness goes across all of this. So,
and I would say that, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I would say the craziness is within that system as well.
Yeah.
And there's a lot. And thank you for saying moving bills. I know there's a number that are being introduced, and we're going to do some good work this year.
Yeah, I certainly think we are, Representative Hamilton. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Can you clarify then the $600 million that we get back as a state in the rebates? What's the trail on that money? Where does that go?
Mr. Hope.
Madam Chair, Representative, that money is split between both the state and the federal government, CMS, based on the basically the percentage of the claim that the federal government or the state pays. So in aggregate, I believe it's somewhere around the high 50s to low 60% overall gets returned to the federal government, because the majority of the claim is paid by the federal government, and then the state, it goes to the general fund, I believe, is where that goes.
It goes to the general fund.
Representative Haley. Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe ultimately it offsets these services for the pharmacy program.
Okay. And can I ask one follow-up question?
Representative Haley.
When you talked about changing the labor part of the equation, the $335 a prescription to $1048 seems, you know, three times the amount. How will we fund that increase? You said some of that will come from lower drug costs, but is there a huge problem coming our way?
Cost increase?
Madam Chair, Representative, this framework would have a cost associated with it. I'm blanking on the number. I wanted to say it was in the low single-digit $1 million per year. There are savings on the drug side. We're also looking at savings through the 340B reimbursement, as well as managing the hemophilia clotting factor. But one of the challenges we have within our program is we have historically been very efficient purchasers of prescription drugs. So these new federal requirements come at a cost to the state. We attempted to show CMS that we were in compliance with the spirit of the rule, which requires that we pay no more than the in the aggregate than the actual acquisition cost plus professional dispensing fee. And that's what we attempted to show them by calculations in 2017. Unfortunately, they didn't accept our calculation, and then they're requiring us to make this change.
Representative Haley?
Okay. I have just one quick question. In the grand scheme of this, I think so many of us feel like this is out of our control, this unwieldy system. In your position, and folks like you that work for other states all over the country, do you have negotiating power with the federal government, or do you band together to talk about the increases in these drugs? I met with some folks this morning that talked about, 22% increase in asthma and COPD drugs, a 30% increase in antipsychotic drugs. I mean, we've all heard it, 100% increase in this drug. Who gets to pound on whose door to say we've got to get in control of this and we've got to stop it? Is there anything on your end that where you're having that discussion as states back to the federal government?
Yeah, Representative Haley, I don't know if Mr. Hope is really in the right position to be, you know, he probably in his job isn't one of the people who would be doing that. He can contradict me if I'm wrong, but I would say that we have a certain amount of, you know, ability to pressure our federal representatives. I know there are a number of bills that have been proposed in Congress, and probably through National Conference of State Legislatures, which we belong to as a state. You know, there are certain ways that states do get together. And I wouldn't be surprised if Medicaid directors are working together. I think they have an organization, too. But I don't know, Mr. Hope, do you have anything to add to that?
Madam Chair, Representative, you're absolutely correct. We do have as many conversations with other states as possible, but ultimately the pricing FDA approval process and the calculation for the rebates, the states have no control over that because it's either not controlled under the Medicaid program or it's prescribed in federal law. So we're very limited in what tools we have. We do try to provide as much education. For example, the fact that we cannot discuss rebates and drug pricing, that's good information to get out there. But as far as actually being able to impact what CMS does, I would love the opportunity to have that ability, but I haven't seen it yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you for just going on record to say that.
Yeah. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for your willingness to share this information. And my concern is, you know, I come from a rural district, and I got a letter at the beginning of session of an independent drugstore yet in one of my small communities, and they're just about ready to close the doors. And when we had the pharmacy people up here, pharmacy day or whatever at the Capitol, one of the things that some of the pharmacists said is when they fill a prescription, they actually lose money on filling the prescription. It costs them more than what when they fill it. Now, the other thing, I just had two pharmacies close in my district also. So my concern is that what we're seeing is, number one, you're getting bigger and bigger chains in the pharmaceutical area. The independent, small independent people are being pushed out. And especially in rural small communities, they're going to lose their access to prescription drugs, or they're going to have to drive a long ways in order to get their prescriptions filled. And a lot of those people are seniors with limited mobility in some cases. And is that part, you know, when they fill a prescription, they actually lose money? Is that part of the Medicaid reimbursement? You know, Representative Haley kind of touched on the 365 versus the 1048. Or is that connected to the CMS and the pharmacy benefit managers? Or what's exactly bringing that about? Because I never heard that years ago.
And Representative Grunhagen, remember, too, that, and I'm going to let Mr. Hope answer, but remember there are also these different systems of reimbursement he talked about at the beginning. So, you know, yeah, some of it is going to be through managed care, just talking about our public programs now, not the private side at all, but some of it is going to be through managed care, some of it is going to be fee-for-service. And Mr. Hope, do you want to try to address it?
Madam Chair, Representative, and yes, that is one point that I failed to make clear during the second part of the presentation. The outpatient drug rule applies to the fee-for-service program only. The whole federal construct of the outpatient drug rule is intended to make sure that situations like that don't happen over and over and over again, because you're attempting to ensure that you're paying for the parts appropriately and the labor appropriately. And that's why we also worked on coupling it with a cost of dispensing survey, so that while we're using a surrogate marker from Indiana initially, we would also be conducting ongoing and periodic measurements of what it actually costs a pharmacy to dispense the drug in Minnesota. And then we can break that out and look at various different components. Is it different in the Twin Cities versus rural or by drug type? Those are all normal components of a prescription, a cost of dispensing program.
Just one quick
thing. Representative Grunhagen, so this is, let me just say, this is one more area where we see under managed care, we have no control over that very thing. Anyway, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do you see that we can solve this problem at the legislature here, or at least begin to address it? Because you're basically going to have fewer and fewer pharmacies out there in the rural area, and we're already facing a crisis of doctor shortages and constricting, you know, hospital access and medical access. It just, you know, I know it's not a simple solution probably, but any thoughts on how to address that?
Mr. Hope.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's hard to speak to the specifics of that specific individual, though I would say that the proposal and framework that we've worked on with the stakeholders, including the Minnesota Hospital Association and the Pharmacist Association, would not only be a compliant proposal for the outpatient drug rule, but it's intended to be fair and ensure that we have providers for our members.
All right. So thank you, Representative Grunhagen. We, and, you know, just to be clear, members, this is such a big, important topic. We could talk about this for hours. We have. We will continue to. But we do need to move on. But I have Neuer, Schumacher, and Hamilton. So Representative Neuer.
Madam Chair, the question was about the fee-for-service, and that question was answered. I think Doug had the question when I was raising the hand at the same time. Doug. Right.
Thank you very much. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hope, just wondering, on the slide 12 there with the CMS rule, and really just what happens if we don't conform with that? I know you have the federal financial participation option there, but just really what does happen if we just decide not to conform?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Hope.
Madam Chair, Representative, Unfortunately, I don't know what ultimately could or would happen at the end of the day. We had been engaging CMS since 2017. They have alerted us that the loss of federal funding is possible, but we don't know how possible. Is it a portion, effective when? Those just aren't answers that we have.
And yeah, Representative Schumacher.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just how much is that funding, Mr. Hope?
Mr. Hope.
Madam Chair, Representative, we had initially estimated it at about $190 million.
Great. Thank you, Representative Schumacher, for bringing that out. That's a really important point. Representative Hamilton, final question on this segment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, builds off of what Representative Grunhagen was saying. What I'd like to know, Mr. Hope, if you could provide this with us, we have pharmacy benefits managers who are owned by pharmacists. And these benefits managers will set reimbursement rates for pharmacies across the state. And I would like to know whether or not that reimbursement rate is the exact same for each one of those pharmacies, because I have information, I believe, that would say it is not, and that some of the larger pharmacies is receiving a higher reimbursement rate for the exact same drug that our small rural pharmacies are receiving that is filling those prescriptions at a loss. So I'd like that information, if you can provide it, or one of your colleagues. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Hope, do you have that information?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have that information, but we'll go back to our legislative team and see if we can find anything to attempt to answer your question.
Thank you. And I think, Representative Hamilton, when we had the presentation from Professor Schondelmeyer, I think that was one of the things he talked about, in fact, that they do kind of prefer certain pharmacies and will, you know, that they own often, and will give them different reimbursements. So there is indeed a real systemic problem here.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Hope. We appreciate it. We appreciate your taking some of these questions, and I'm sure we'll have more discussion of this topic.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So we're going to hear House File 182, Representative Lippert. And welcome to the committee, Representative Lippert. Since you're not on this committee, I'm going to move House File 182 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Or wait, are we going to? Is that where you wanted your bill to go, or are we going to send it back up the chain here? Because are we going to
possible inclusion?
So House File 182 is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division bill.
Correct.
So, and we're going to discuss a little bit about the fiscal issue in the course of this hearing. So, welcome to the committee, Representative Lippert. Why don't you give an introduction to your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm Todd Lippert. I'm glad to be presenting this bill on establishing a repository program in the state of Minnesota. This idea is not new or unusual. There are 21 other states that have a drug repository system or program currently. Last year, this bill had bipartisan support, and it was included in the supplemental omnibus bill that was fully vetoed by Governor Dayton. This year, this bill has bipartisan support as well. Currently, in long-term care centers, there's a lot of medication that goes to waste because of federal packaging regulations. So when a patient dies or if a patient's medications change, even if medications are in a monthly blister pack like this or in single-use doses, that medication often has to be thrown away because of federal regulations related to packaging. So what this will do is essentially establish a charitable pharmacy where unused, untampered with medications can be sent This bill also allows for individuals to send medications that would qualify to this central repository. And then people who are uninsured, underinsured, don't have access to pharmaceutical coverage can then access these medications for little or no money at all. The state of Wyoming and the state of Iowa both have long established and very successful drug repository programs. The state of Wyoming's program has repurposed $12.5 million over the course of about 10 years, and the state of Iowa has repurposed $17.7 million worth of pharmaceuticals over about 10 years as well. At this time, I'll turn to first testifier Rowan Mann, who can tell us more.
Thank you, Representative Lippert. And before we do that, I just note we have a lot of visitors in the room, so I'd like to welcome our visitors from AMC. And I think we also have visitors probably from Minnesota Medical Association. So I'm glad to have everyone here today. And so welcome to the committee, Ms. Mann, and please go ahead and present the bill.
Hi. Thank you for allowing me to come present. I'm Rowan Mann. I'm a pharmacy and Master's of Public Health student at the University of Minnesota, and I've been working with this legislation for medication repositories beginning last session with Representative Keel and now this session with Representative Lippert. I know this is a finance committee, so I'll move through it really quick, but long-term care facilities are having to throw a lot of medications away. The president of care providers, a long-term care agency within Minnesota, their president estimated that their facilities alone are, they could be disposing of approximately up to $16 million of completely safe medications every year. So we have that waste. We also obviously have patients who are having trouble affording their medications, as we had some stories just in the last hearing about that medication costs are an issue and they do affect patient care. So we have that. Other states have been doing it. We have 21 other states. This is heavily based off Iowa's legislation. Iowa's been running for over 10 years, no safety concerns, and they've been able to repurpose over 71,000 patients for over $17.7 million worth of medications. And I'm going to pass it over to Dr. Nori Thomas. She is a fellow with the Center for Leading Healthcare Change, and she has extensive experience in pharmacy business, and she's going to talk to you about the return of investment value and what this can bring to the state. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Thomas.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Nori Thomas. I'm an adjunct faculty at the College of Pharmacy in the Center for Leading Healthcare Change, and faculty support to Rowan, who we should congratulate her. She just finished her master's in public health. So she'll be finishing her pharmacy degree next year, but she's well on her way. As faculty to the College of Pharmacy, I think you should know that the College of Pharmacy here at Minnesota is ranked second in the nation, primarily for research and clinical, but also because all of our pharmacy students must study leadership day one. And Rowan, of course, is our poster child for leadership. When you look at the return on investment, and I should also say my background is in pharmacy managed care, so the previous discussion was quite interesting. I am a retired pharmacist and, as I said, adjunct to the College of Pharmacy. When you look at the return on investment, it's 7-1. In Iowa and in Oklahoma, the financial returns are really tremendous. So we are excited about moving this program forward. We do have a number of entities that have come forward that will probably apply to be the central repository, and those institutions will be either federally qualified clinics or large hospital systems. Going forward, I know I will be working with the students to market the program and to make sure that throughout the state we have the visibility that this service is of benefit to people in Minnesota. So with that, I'll open up to questions in the budget, but we have proposed some budget information, and I believe this committee will discuss that.
Great. All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. We have Dr. Weiberg on the list as well, but maybe before we do that, members, so normally when we have a bill like this, and this is the Finance Committee, this is a bill that does require an appropriation. You will notice you don't have a fiscal note. Mm-hmm. Mr. Berg is going to discuss why that is the case, and anyway, go ahead, Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair and members, yes, there is a pending fiscal note request, and Dr. Weiberg has worked on it, and there's some data in conversation between Ms. Mann and Representative Lippert and myself and Dr. Weiberg. We realized the fiscal note needed some further work, and it wasn't actually reflecting quite everything in the bill. It's at this point, it looks at the board's cost of doing business, but hasn't recognized anything that Ms. Mann is talking about for the cost of the repository. And there's also a little bit of an issue on if you notice the blank is in there as a blank appropriation from the general fund, which is likely appropriate for any grant that would go to run the repository, but Dr. Weiberg's costs would more appropriately come from the health board fund. His data's in at this point as general fund because that's what the bill specifies, so we need just a little bit further work between all of us to fix the fiscal note.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Berg, and I'll let Dr. Weiberg address that as well, but I think the bottom line is we thought we had a fiscal note for today, and then because of some last-minute issues, it didn't happen, but we expect we'll have one soon, and, of course, the bill's being laid over, so we'll have that for members as soon as we get it. Dr. Weiberg, did you want to address that or anything else?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, and as you probably know, fiscal notes have to be done based on the way the bill's drafted, and I think Mr. Berg already mentioned that. When I did look at this, when I first looked at this, I must admit, I saw the appropriation glossed over general fund. And when I went to do the fiscal note, it's like, why does this say general fund? Because what the appropriation piece in this bill does is it appropriates money to the board, and it's a very small amount of money we're going to need to actually do the RFP and to manage it. And I think, though, what Ms. Mann would like, and I had discussions with her and told her she really would need to talk to the legislators, maybe you, she would like, I think, some money that's appropriated out of the general fund to go to the repository for the first few years of their operations. That's not reflected in this bill. So, but that's why general fund was put in there instead of the normal budget. So that's what the process is. Just to, you know, to let you know, our costs to actually do the RFP and to administer it are at most going to be about $14,000 to $16,000 a year. We need just that increase in our appropriation. And then, you know, I have told Ms. Mann that it would be up to the legislature to decide what, if anything, out of the general fund to give to the repositories themselves, and indicated that if it was in the form of a grant that the board would give, we'd be okay with that, but we don't have $500,000 in our budget to give to the repository. Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Weiberg. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions on the bill. It's a great idea. I was a co-author last year on the legislation. But I have a question on the accountability of the program. Is there anything? I didn't see anything about reporting on how much money it's saving, because I believe this bill pays 250% of the medical assistance dispensing cost for dispensing these prescriptions or recycling these prescriptions. And if it's a low cost, you know, a $2 or $3 a drug that's being redispensed, it may be a net loss to the program. So I'm wondering if there's accountability that's, you know, 2 or 3 years down the road that'll show us what a benefit this is. And then is there anything that addresses like a safety concern about having an individual responsible for collecting and transporting prescription drugs, and what kind of record keeping is checked on both sides? And if you could speak to those, that would be thankful.
So that's at least three questions there. I don't know if you all got them. Ms. Mann, do you want to take a crack at it? Do you want to do you have them down?
Yeah,
okay. Dr.
I might, especially the safety concerns. I might want to address that, or I might be the most appropriate one. So, Madam Chair, Representative Munson, first of all, like I mentioned at the last hearing, Ms. Mann and her fellow students deserve all the credit here, but they did come to me, and I did redraft the legislation in a manner, I used Iowa law as a model, in a manner that I thought would address any concerns that the board might have on safety. So, yes, there is language in there that basically, first of all, requires the repositories to be licensed pharmacies and or distributors under the board's purview. They will be inspected just like every other facility that we inspect with our licensed pharmacists that are employed by us that are inspectors and surveyors. In addition, there are requirements in the language for a pharmacist to check the medications and to make sure that there, you know, there's no obvious signs that there's any problems with this. My understanding in other states is the vast majority of drugs do come in from long-term care facilities, and those long-term care facilities have rules administered by the Department of Health in terms of how drugs need to be stored in proper temperature and humidity conditions. And so I'm satisfied with the safety measures that are in place in the bill. In terms of accountability, I'm not sure that there's something that says that in this language that says that the programs have to report the value of the products that they receive and dispense. There are requirements for them to report information to the board periodically in terms of the number of people that enroll and the sort of drugs that they're getting. But I don't think there was anything there specifically about them reporting cost information. And in terms of the amount that they're allowed to charge, which I looked at as one way that they might be able to fund their operations, this is, again, based on what Iowa did. Iowa basically said that to help recover the cost of operating the repository, they could collect up to 250% of the Medicaid dispensing fee. As you just heard from Dr. Hope, that's going up. And so that might be, if anything, I would be more worried if that goes up that the patient would be paying too much. But the language is written so they can charge up to that amount. They don't necessarily have to charge that amount.
Representative Munson.
So the 250% of the dispensing fee, if the fees were to go up from $3 to $10, then it could be, you know, $25 as a dispensing fee, just to clarify that. It's not a dollar amount. It's actually a percentage of the MA disbursement fee.
Dr. Weiber.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, yes.
Yeah. Ms. Mann.
Yep. Hi. So that language is, as Dr. Weiber said, directly from Iowa. And I can tell you that in Iowa, even though they have that language, and it is a safety net to help increase if you do need funding for this program, none of their pharmacies that utilize this program ask for that 250% to be collected from patients. And they have over 200 partnerships across their state. And when I've been talking to the agencies that could run this program, we do specifically talk about that language, and no one has ever seemed interested in actually using it. It is a safety net.
All right, thank you. All right, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Munson covered some of the terrain I wanted to ask about with the repository, but I did want to check with Representative Lippert. Knowing this is a health committee, and I wanted to make sure this is a healthy cookie for me.
Yeah, that's right.
We have rules here.
That's right.
Okay. All right.
Thank you for that.
I did have two questions, follow up on the repository thing. I just wanted to make sure that in those repositories, following on to Representative Munson, that there will not be any pharmaceutical benefit manager employed there.
Okay. The agencies that would run the central repository are either going to be a wholesaler or a pre-existing pharmacy. The way that I've been working on the implementation plan for this last year in that layover, and there are multiple pharmacies that are interested in running this, particularly if we can guarantee funding either through state funding or through grants. That's, and they would not be PBMs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to follow up on that.
Bierman.
And then federal and state laws requiring some drugs to be returned to the pharmaceuticals, are there many of those products that coming from retirement homes, et cetera? I'd read that there's certain drugs you can't, that have to go back to pharmacies if they're not used.
Yeah. Dr. Weiberg, maybe you'd.
Madam Chair, Representative, so there's at least two sorts of situations I can think of. There is language about both of them in the bill. So one involves the fact that, you know, that Dr. Hope was just here, as it happens, 13 and a half years ago. I was Dr. Hope. I had that same position. Unless things have changed, state law does require when drugs are dispensed by a pharmacy to long-term care facilities, certain long-term care facilities, and they're covered by Medicaid, and they're in appropriate packaging, that they're supposed to be returned by the nursing home to the pharmacy to credit the Medicaid program. There's language in here that says those drugs can't be returned, or they have to be returned, or can't be donated, they have to be returned to the pharmacy so that Medicaid can be credited. The other thing you may be referring to are what are called REMS drugs. And the FDA, when it approves drugs, if there are drugs that are particularly dangerous, one I can think of offhand is a drug called Accutane that's used for acne, but it also is teratogenic and can cause birth defects. So those drugs have to be handled in a very strict, limited way, and those sorts of drugs would not go to this repository either because of the safety concerns.
Representative Bierman? Is that okay? Thank you. Other questions, members? How unusual. We have 5 minutes, and we're not, and okay, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Ms. Mann. I know you've been working on this for a couple of years, and I hope in the future we have more MPH and pharmacy students coming forward with bill, really good bills. So thank you for the faculty members working with our students, and I encourage any students listening to bring us some ideas for good bills. So thanks again, Ms. Mann.
Yeah, amen to that, Representative Schultz. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is for whoever was drafting the bill this year. I noticed one of the differences between this year's bill and last year's is that there wasn't a sunset in here. And I know we were talking about some of the accountability and the checks in there. That was there, was it a decision to not have a sunset in there, or is that something you'd be open to as we go through this process?
Ms. Mann.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. Yes, the sunset was added in conference committee. It wasn't in the language that was introduced through the House or that went through the House. And we did remove it. If it needs to go back in, I'm okay with that. But I thought I would prefer to not start off with any limitations, and they can be added along the way.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. And just to go back for a moment to Representative Bierman's comment, Representative Lippert is not on this committee, so he didn't know about our rule about healthy treats. But I hope that we'll start actually honoring the rule. And it's hard because in the other committees they don't have such a rule. But this is a health committee, so I am at least trying to get people to think about bringing healthy treats to this committee. I know, Representative Zerwas, that is not where you want to go. But please, Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, if you notice, I think Representative Lippert is very cognizant of bringing heart-shaped cookies. It's certainly very, very healthy themed. So I appreciate that.
Yes, I appreciate that the sentiment,
that
Representative Zerwas.
So true.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we are almost done with the committee. I just do want to also thank Ms. Mann. She has really been tremendous, and congratulations on completing at least one of your degrees, and it has been, and it is great to have you around here as a citizen advocate, which is a very important thing. Dr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, off the topic of this very quickly, there are questions I think that Dr. Hope could not answer in his role at DHS. Some of those questions involve pharmacy benefit managers. While we do not at the Board of Pharmacy directly license or regulate them, there are about a dozen different provisions in the Pharmacy Practice Act that deal with how they do audits and how they do maximum allowable costs. So the Board does have a little bit of purview here, and to the extent that I'm not working on other legislation like opioids and things like that, I would be more than happy to assist any of the members with questions about pharmacy benefit managers.
That's great. Thank you, Dr. Weiberg. And And we are going to be having a lot more discussion, and we appreciate having you as a resource on these issues and many other issues. Before we adjourn, I also just want to thank Mr. McCall, who's been sitting in for a couple days while our regular committee administrator is on vacation. We really appreciate his assistance. And if there are no other questions, we need to thank you. See, he's helping me out here. So House File 182 is laid over for possible inclusion in the division bill. So thank you very much. And we will share the fiscal note with members when we do receive that. And since there is no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.